Today at Reader's Corner, Kirsten Downey, author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life and Legacy of Frances Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor, and His Moral Conscience.
She would go in, recognize a problem, work on finding a solution, get the legislation passed, get the program enacted, and allow others often to take credit for it. FDR had an unusual ability to recognize the strengths of women at a time that this was a very unusual thing to do. Frances Perkins could visualize it, Eleanor Roosevelt could popularize it, and Franklin Roosevelt could make it happen. 40-hour work week, overtime compensation, and of course Social Security was very much her plan when FDR brought her into his administration.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Her legacy impacts every American, yet Frances Perkins is hardly a household name. One of the most influential women of the 20th century, she was named Secretary of Labor by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1933. As the nation's first female cabinet secretary, she spearheaded the fight to improve the lives of America's working people while juggling her own complex family responsibilities. Her greatest triumph was creating Social Security. Journalist Kirsten Downey spent 9 years researching and writing The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life and Legacy of Frances Perkins, Social Security, Unemployment Insurance, and the Minimum Wage. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Ms. Downey. She is a former longtime reporter with The Washington Post. In 2008, she shared the Pulitzer Prize awarded to the Post staff for coverage of the campus slayings at Virginia Tech. Ms. Downey joins us by phone for this interview. Kirsten Downey, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much.
What a remarkable woman. The first thing I thought of when I finished the book is that this is a story of the thoroughly modern woman long before women enjoyed the equality and access in the workplace that they do today.
That is one of the things that fascinated me about her so much, is that Frances Perkins had a long record of accomplishments before she was even 40 years old, and it was at age 40 that she first got the right to vote.
You know, you'd think when you read this book about all she did and how strongly she felt about things, the way she made them happen, that she would be one of these pie-eyed idealists. And yet, she had this incredible pragmatic streak in her that allowed her to manipulate the system, and I mean to use that word manipulate in the very best way, to make good things happen. And the one example that I remember is the way she hung around with some of those Tammany Hall guys, who in many ways were crooks in their own right, but she knew how to figure them out and use them, right?
Well, she was very honest and realistic in her evaluations of the people that were around her. And she knew that every human being is a combination of good and bad. And whereas a lot of people who are idealists would be disgusted by the bad that they saw, for example, in a corrupt Tammany Hall politician, she saw that there was the potential to reach out to help them find that good in themselves, too. So whereas a person might be on the take in a lot of ways, quite a corrupt official, they may also realize that their constituents were being hurt by bad labor or working conditions, and she could get them to ally with her to talk about helping to fix social problems. And it was part of her brilliance, working with people in that way.
You know, one of the things that I find interesting about her life and career, especially as a university president who deals these days especially with students who graduate and don't always get their ideal job, and they have to settle for something less. In Frances Perkins' history and career, there were numerous jobs she took that were not the ideal job for her, but her career, your recording of her career, sends such a strong message to young people about a job is what you make of it. No matter what your assignment, do something special with it. And I think of the fact that under her aegis at the Department of Labor was immigration. And during World War II, share with us how she used that immigration office to really reach out across the Atlantic to Germans who were in harm's way.
Well, you've raised a lot of really good issues right in a row here. But your point, what you saw about her life paralleling the experience of young people today, is so true. You know, she came out of Mount Holyoke in 1902. And at first, it was very hard for her to find a job. She had a series of essentially temp jobs. She'd be a fill-in worker. And I think a lot of kids right now going into adulthood are having this experience themselves. She had a series of temp jobs. And she finally found one full-time job. She had to move to Chicago to get a full-time job. And she to pursue the things that she really wanted to, she had to volunteer. So for her, it was a full-time job teaching, but part-time work volunteering at Hull House as a social worker. Then, though, for her to become a full social worker, she had to essentially run her own small startup nonprofit. And she went and dealt with the issue of basically sexual trafficking of immigrants who were being brought into the United States from Eastern Europe and brought in through Philadelphia. She had to raise the money to run this organization, to pay her small staff. It was a very hard beginning, but it gave her incredibly good skills and a very good understanding of the immigrant experience. She was able to go back to school then, and it wasn't until she was 29 or 30 years old that she had her first full-time, regular job where somebody else was raising the money to pay her salary. But the variety of things that she'd done prepared her very well, that when she became Secretary of Labor and found herself overseeing also the Department of Immigration and Naturalization as part of the Department of Labor, she had a very good understanding of the immigrant experience, very good network of contacts within immigrants. And she became very early aware of the very serious problems that Europeans in particular were facing as Hitler came to power. And of course, what we know she was able to do with that really good knowledge of immigrant networks was that Frances Perkins was successful in bringing tens of thousands of intellectuals, trade unionists, and Jews to the United States to safety.
Not long ago, I had an opportunity to see, I think it was an HBO special, but it's a documentary on the Triangle Shirtwaist Company fire in New York's Washington Square in 1911. And you just mentioned the fact that Frances had all these incredible experiences in her younger years. That was certainly one of them. She was there on the scene. Could you explain that fire, her observance of that, and how that influenced what she would do later in life?
Yes, and actually that's just coincident with the time I've told you was that first paid job she had. She was working as the New York City director of a group called the National Consumers League, a group that still exists and is very active on some of the same issues in America, by the way. Frances Perkins was having tea with friends in Washington Square Park in New York City, and they heard shouting and yelling and the clanging of bells. They ran out into the street, and they saw a building across the park ablaze. She ran across the park and actually arrived at the base of the building just as the first women started to jump to their deaths. She was a witness of a horrible event. 146 people died that day. But as a result of her groundbreaking work that she was already working on, she was able to help organize a committee called the Committee on Safety that became associated with actually those Tammany Hall politicians that you mentioned at the beginning of our discussion. And with them, they held hands together, I guess you might say, and they used this terrible tragedy as a way to shine a light on bad workplace conditions in a lot of different ways. And of course, the biggest legacy of that is our fire safety laws, which have saved many scores of lives ever since. Things like the fact that we have fire drills, the fact that we have exit signs and occupancy limits. These are all things that they learned because of the tragedy of the Shirtwaist Fire, and that Frances Perkins helped find ways to put into law to prevent those things from happening again.
Well, you know, I want to talk about Social Security in a minute because, of course, she's considered the author of the Social Security legislation. But whether it's advocating mandatory fire drills, automatic sprinklers, fire escapes, building an expertise in building codes, which she did, she has so many of these things to her credit. And in those days, I would imagine it was not... You would not expect a woman to be the expert on building codes, for example, in those days. And yet she was. And today her name appears nowhere in the record about these advances. Why did she not gain the recognition that she so rightfully deserves. I mean, you're giving it to her in your book, but over the years, did she get it accordingly?
I think at the time that she was alive, a lot of people realized that she was very unusual, and she was fairly well known in her times, but she never sought publicity. She never went out. She was never the one that was chasing the reporters down to be the quote in each story. And in fact, she found in her life that she could be a lot more effective if she moved from effort to effort and allowed others to take credit for it. So she would go in, recognize a problem, work on finding a solution, get the legislation passed, get the program enacted, and allow others often to take credit for it, and then move on to the next thing that was on a list of items, and I describe at the front of the book this really audacious list of items that she gave to FDR before she would agree to be his Secretary of Labor. She gave him this 10 or so item list that included all the things that we've mentioned earlier, the ban on child labor, 40-hour work week, overtime compensation, unemployment compensation, and, of course, Social Security. She had thought these things out. And this was very much her plan when FDR brought her into his administration. And he trusted her so much that he allowed her to do all this. And, of course, the things that she accomplished really were enormously beneficial for FDR's own political career.
You're listening to Kirsten Downey. She's the author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Frances Perkins, FDR Secretary of Labor, and His Moral Conscience. Let's talk for a moment, if we could, about the people she hung out with, and we'll get into the Social Security issue. Teddy Roosevelt, Al Smith, Senator Robert Wagner, just an incredible array of really important people of the day, the most important politicians in America. And there's a quote that you found from the assistant to Senator Robert Wagner, which I found so compelling and so interesting in terms of her impact. This is the quote: "I don't think President Roosevelt had the remotest interest in a Social Security bill or program. He was simply pacifying Frances." And I guess that gets to your point about how good she was at working with people in power. But it also is a bit of an interesting message. I grew up in a family that revered Franklin D. Roosevelt, and I'm sure they thought he wrote every last line of that Social Security
yeah.
bill. And now I'm learning that thank goodness Frances was there, or none of it would have happened.
Well, and she played a very big role. But FDR also was a unique person himself. He had an unusual ability to recognize the strengths of women at a time that this was a very unusual thing to do. He had a very strong mother, he had a very strong wife, and he had a very strong friendship and trust with Frances Perkins. And the combination of those people in his life really helped to make him as successful as he was. Frances was really great at coming up with ideas and thinking about how a program could be administered. Eleanor Roosevelt, FDR's wife, was amazingly adept at popularizing ideas and explaining to people why they were needed. And, of course, though, it was FDR's political brilliance that could allow things to happen that in any other time would have been almost unimaginable. One of the quotes that just really always amazed me was, just a few years before unemployment insurance passed, Tom Elliott, who was one of the young lawyers in the Labor Department, remembered that if you said the word unemployment insurance, it would just draw a big laugh. It seemed laughable. But Frances Perkins thought it could be a way that we could sort of take the rough edge off capitalism, help people get through the lows that happen in capitalism. Of course, that's one of the programs that we've used so successful in these last few years of this downturn. We have 10 million people right now on unemployment insurance. And imagine what the world would be like right now for those families if that program didn't exist. But Frances Perkins could visualize it. Eleanor Roosevelt could popularize it. And Franklin Roosevelt could make it happen.
Wow, that's very well put. What was life like for the nation's first female cabinet member? Was she respected by her peers, and how did she interact with them to the extent that she had the opportunity?
Well, she knew it was going to be very, very rough before she went to Washington. She knew she would be living her life in a fishbowl. She was very worried about it because she was married. Her husband was mentally ill. He had bipolar disorder. And she had a teenage daughter, and she knew her daughter would also be under a lot of scrutiny. So she took the job with a lot of trepidation. In fact, she cried very, very hard on the night that she knew she was going to accept the job, knowing what was going to happen. And in fact, it was a very difficult road for her. It was very difficult for men to accept a woman as a peer on the cabinet. The other cabinet officers would pass notes about her and roll their eyes often when she talked. Even other women found it very difficult to accept a woman as a peer with men. It made them jealous of her, and I think that was one of the things that may have been a problem for her in her friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt, is that Eleanor was doing as well as she could in an environment that at that time was not very welcoming to women. But Frances Perkins had been included among the men, and that was very hard for women, including Eleanor, to accept. So Frances had a very lonely road.
I'm sure this next question isn't going to sit too well with young feminists out there who wouldn't quite understand what Frances was doing this for, but she had a nickname called Ma Perkins. And
yes.
I guess early in her career, you can help us understand this, she actually figured out that even how she dressed would be an advantage, even if by today's standards it may not seem very appropriate for a young woman in today's life. Tell us just what she did with her own personal style of dressing.
Well, this is a fascinating thing, and this is one of the things I just enjoyed so much researching and learning about, and it's made me think about my own life and the people that I think of and the people who are successful also. She thought of herself really as a really pretty radical person. Obviously, a lot of the things that she was doing were called socialist. They were called communist. The idea of an eight-hour day was considered a socialist proposal when she was a young woman. And what she decided to do to cope with some of these things, in the interests of popularizing them, making people understand why they were important, was she tried to put on a persona that would be very non-threatening. Now, you see, when she was a young girl, she loved those Gibson Girl blouses with all the lace, and she'd wear her hair up in an elaborate top knot. She loved beautiful things. She loved furs, and she loved nice clothing. But she realized that she could be most effective if she reminded people of a motherly person, really of a matron. And so when she was just a young woman, just in her early 30s, she started to make herself over to look very matronly. And she consciously adopted a look that people would associate with a middle-aged mother. Dark jacket, a little string of pearls around her neck, her hair pulled back very tightly into a bun, a little hat on her head, a look that identified her with motherhood. Because she said she realized that men had a really hard time accepting a woman in public life unless they could identify her with the one woman that most men respect above all others, and that's their own mother.
Well, you know, you mentioned her own mother and, of course, her difficult personal life. She juggled a personal life that would be challenging all by itself. You mentioned her mentally ill husband. And then when you put that on top of the demands of her professional life and career, help us understand what was going on there, and especially how she became estranged from her daughter. And did she die estranged from her daughter?
Yes, I would say that she did. It's really a tragic story. And it really is the story of the world before we had medications for bipolar disorder. When Frances first met her husband-to-be, Paul Wilson, he was brilliant, he was charming, he was the right-hand man to the mayor of New York City, and she thought that she was going to be able to be an at-home wife with an active volunteer life. Unfortunately, within a few years after marrying him, he had a very serious onset of bipolar disorder. He never really recovered from it. He'd have only brief periods that he was well. What that meant is that she had to support her family. She became the sole support of both her husband and her daughter, Susanna. Another tragedy happened in her life, and that was that Susanna inherited the ailment as well. She got ill when she was about 19 years old and never really had a full period of good health herself. Unfortunately, in those days, Susanna, her daughter, had a lot of therapy about why she felt so bad. And over time, she came to believe that she felt so bad because her mother had been a career woman. One of the great tragedies of Frances Perkins' life is that although she was a good wife and a good mother, she never really got the appreciation that she should have gotten because she had family members who were really too ill to be grateful.
Let's talk for a moment about what Congress tried to do to her. I mean, here's this woman with all these incredible accomplishments, and in 1939, Congress tries to impeach her?
Yes. Well, you made a reference earlier on to the immigration issue, and this is a really big thing in Frances Perkins' life. And she had not come to Washington really thinking that she was going to be waving a flag for immigration. And in fact, at that point, the laws against immigration were very strict. There was very strong anti-immigrant feeling in the United States. So as things started to get very bad in Europe and overseas, instead of them being able to easily bring immigrants into the United States, they found that opposition to immigration actually grew. So she was on the hot seat on that issue in a lot of ways. In addition to European immigrants who were trying to get into the United States, there was also the issue that a lot of very successful trade unionists who were organizing some of these big trade union movements were also immigrants. And one of them in particular was a man named Harry Bridges. He came from Australia. And when he began successfully organizing the West Coast, and a lot of people will remember the famous waterfront strike and general strike of San Francisco, the fact that he was from Australia made him an easy subject of attack by business leaders who wanted him deported. They said he was a communist and a union organizer and that he should be deported. Frances Perkins came under a lot of pressure to deport him as part of this whole anti-immigrant sentiment that was spreading all over the country. She actually gave him a full trial. She gave him the full right to a hearing. He was acquitted of being a communist in that hearing. But as a result of a congressman feeling like she had not moved quickly enough to deport him, she suffered a humiliating impeachment attempt where allegations were made against her for some months. It took months before she was finally able to go in and in public hearing respond to the criticisms and explain why she had handled the Harry Bridges case in the way that she had. By the time she was allowed to defend herself, her reputation was ruined on the immigration issue. Immigration and naturalization was taken away from her, and that happened in 1939. As we all know, that was when conditions in Europe were getting the worst, when immigrants most needed to come to the United States. That was the point at which Frances Perkins, who was the most sympathetic to their plight on the cabinet, was precluded from being able to help them. So it had a long-lasting negative result, even on FDR's reputation, because he's been frequently criticized for not having let more people come into the United States in 1939 and 1940 and 41.
Well, that's what I was thinking about in my next question. What did FDR, what role did he play in this? Did President Roosevelt stand up for this woman who he appointed labor secretary or just let her dangle on the vine there?
Well, he shared her concerns about immigrants, and he let her make some changes in law. For example, he let her introduce a program called the Charge Bond Program, where an immigrant could come to the United States if someone would pledge that they would cover for them if they were unable to find a job and they became a drain or had to be turning to charity, that someone would step up and pledge that they would cover for them. So he supported her in setting up some programs that saved a lot of lives. Very early on, he was concerned about immigration, but he was a very savvy politician. And he could read the tea leaves. The fact is, the American people were deeply opposed to immigration. And he went with the majority opinion. He didn't do anything to allow large numbers of people to be admitted. And in fact, he did this partially also on the advice of his own State Department, because they were very State Department officials were very worried about also about what was happening all over the world, and they were wanting to make sure the United States didn't do anything to cause hostilities to break out even more quickly for Americans. So there were some real concerns that if we did much in the United States, we could cause war to come faster. They had some real concerns, but the fact is that Roosevelt's failure to act has been a blot on his reputation, and I am sorry to say, no, he did not step up publicly to Frances Perkins' defense when she was undergoing the impeachment attempt.
She did have some very specific strategies in dealing with FDR, didn't she?
Yes, she did. She understood him very well. He trusted her completely, and she was very loyal to him. She sometimes said that one of the things that happens in a cabinet is all the people who are on the staff of the cabinet, mostly all men, all have political aspirations. And as soon as they go to work for the president, they start to imagine themselves as the president. They stop doing the things necessarily that are best for the administration. They're starting to look for their own long-time political careers. One of the things that made Frances Perkins unique in the cabinet is that being a woman, she knew she had no higher aspirations. There was no place else she could go. The best she could do was where she was. So what she did is really work as diligently as possible on FDR's agenda. What she did is she looked out for him. She gave him good advice. She gave him excellent support. But he could trust her to tell him what he needed to know. If she had something that she wanted to do, she would tell him about it. She would lay it out. She would lay it out in a story form. She would explain the background of it. Then she would make a suggestion about how it could be solved. But she would tell him also what the possible negative consequences of that decision might be. She would let him decide. But if she had come to the belief that something had to be done and she thought he was willing to do it, she would just never let it go. She would bring it up and bring it up and bring it up. And in fact, that's one of the keys to Social Security, is at some point FDR realized that she had decided that the horror of poor elderly people, and in fact, we need to remember that most elderly people, just like now, have very little in the way of private pensions when they retire, that they needed another kind of system that would give them a public pension that should they get to the end of the road and they had no other source of income, that Social Security would be there for them. That, I think, was the program of which Frances Perkins was the most proud, and she approached it with FDR exactly in that manner. When I said earlier about we have 10 million on unemployment insurance right now, the real thing that's pulled us through this downturn is the existence of Social Security. We have 54 million people right now in America on Social Security. The average benefit is about $1,200 a month, so it's not a lot. But there are tens of millions of families that have had Social Security through this downturn as a source of income for at least some member of the family.
We really do appreciate your role with this book in bringing the life of Frances Perkins back to us, because she clearly is a forgotten woman in American history in the 20th century. You've done a great job. We've run out of time, and I regret that. I would say that anybody who grabs a copy of your book, and I'd highly recommend that, have to look at some of those photos you have, right on down to the administration of John F. Kennedy, where she's in her last years is hanging out with the new president in the 60s. So this is a woman who really spanned history for more than half a century.
That's right, from Teddy Roosevelt to JFK.
That's just amazing. Well, again, the book is The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life and Legacy of Frances Perkins. Kirsten Downey, thank you for joining us today on Reader's
Corner. Thank you so much. It's been a delight.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Kirsten Downey. Next week, Charles C. Mann, author of 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.